Good day. Today is Saturday, 14th February 2026, and today is St. Valentine's Day, and I wish to congratulate everybody, anybody watching this programme who celebrates St. Valentine's Day on this day. Now, my wife and I will definitely be celebrating St. Valentine's Day. In fact, we have a programme that we are going to be doing together. And this definitely does mean that today's programme is going to be shorter than usual. There it is. It only comes round once a year, and it is an important day for us. Now, having said that, let me remind you again, if once you've watched this programme, if you like this programme or whatever part of this programme you've listened to, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, over the last 24 hours, there's been lots of different pieces moving along the geopolitical chessboard. But I'm going to turn first to the situation in Ukraine. Briefly, over the course of the last 24 hours, there's been what appears to me growing tension in Kiev itself, the city of Kiev, with suggestions that the Russians might be preparing a devastating strike, perhaps with an Oreshnik missile, on the centre of Kiev itself, perhaps on government buildings there. There have been reports. I would not regard these as reports, by the way. I would say these are basically rumours. Rumours that Western diplomats have been leaving Kiev in anticipation of this strike. And interestingly, there was a meeting of the Ukrainian parliament, the Rada, where a significant proportion, the majority of the MPs, failed to turn up. The story being that they'd all suffering from a stomach upset. Well, it is that time of year. It's winter. It's very cold in Kiev. There's blackouts. There's lack of electricity. There's lack of heating power. I find it entirely likely that people are generally and truly ill. So it's possible that this is the explanation. But the rumours do connect this again to a worries about a potential Oreshnik strike. And frankly, if that is the case, that would not necessarily surprise me. Now, there were, in fact, reports yesterday of some kind of launch from the Cosmodrome in Russia at Kapustin Yar, the cosmodrome from which Oreshnik missiles have up to now been launched against Ukraine. It's perhaps worth remembering that only two Oreshniks have up to now been launched against Ukraine. The first, an experimental version used against the Yuzhmash factory in the city of Dnipro in November 2024, and a second strike that took place against a major facility for aircraft repair and construction near the western city of Lvov, which took place in January of this year. So we've only actually had two Oreshnik strikes. But anyway, both strikes took place from Kapustin Yar. There was lots of excitement and worry that some major attack was coming because there were reports of this activity at Kapustin Yar. A launch did generally take place, but the Russian authorities said that it was not an Oreshnik, and in fact there was no strike by an Oreshnik on any target in Kiev. But, well, the nervousness, the stress, the fear still exists. As to the launch itself, there are some rumours that this was another missile which is going to form a further part of the panoply of missiles that the Russians are developing and perhaps planning to launch against Ukraine. Some are even referring to it as Oreshnik 2. I don't know. I've heard reports, which I consider reliable, that the Russians are working on a new missile with a thermobaric warhead, in other words, a warhead that can create a fire-type explosion in the places which it strikes, which would be a devastating area weapon. By the way, maybe this was the missile that was tested at Kapustin Yar. I'm not going to speculate further. What this incident does show, putting aside whether people were generally ill or not, putting aside whether the Western diplomats did leave Kiev or not, what this incident shows, what all of the rumours and speculations and fears and comments that have appeared shows, is the extraordinary nervousness that the Oreshnik is causing in Ukraine. Clearly, whatever exactly the effect of the two previous strikes was, and remember, the Ukrainians have never provided us with any details. There's never been independent inspections that we know of to either of these sites, the Yuzhmash factory or the factory near Lvov, nor have we had proper photos or pictures from either of these places. Anyway, whatever the effect was, it's clearly been enough to make people in Kiev very nervous. I'm going to suggest that there is a further reason why people in Kiev might be extremely nervous, and that is that it is looking as if, following the assassination attempt on General Alexeyev, the Russians might indeed be thinking about retaliatory action against Ukraine. And I am going to suggest that over and above and beyond the possible strike by an Oreshnik within the next few days or weeks, which I suspect would be less connected to the attack on General Alexeyev, and which I suspect would be more properly a part of the ongoing missile bombardment of Ukraine by Russia. Putting all of that aside, the Russians have taken certain steps over the last few days, which seem to me to be consistent with a general tightening of security in anticipation of further action, further steps being taken by Russia in relation to the dirty war. The dirty war, the assassination and sabotage campaign conducted by Ukraine on Russian territory, to which the Russians have at various times also responded. And the most obvious clue that the Russians are thinking of doing something of this kind is provided by the recent tightening of internet security that is taking place in Russia. Now, the most obvious step, the one that has clearly been worked on for some time, but most specifically over the last few weeks, is the Russian closure of Telegram, the social media platform in Russia. Telegram was originally created in Russia. Its owner and manager, a man called Pavel Durov, is Russian, though he mostly lives abroad. He is very much somebody who supports free speech positions. But it's fair to say that though he has sometimes been critical of the Russian authorities and has chosen to live outside Russia, he is not obviously or explicitly anti-government, at least not at the present time. And Telegram has been used by senior Russian officials. Dmitry Medvedev has written on it many times. He has, as far as I know, still a social media account there. Most of the Russian groups of forces operating in the Ukrainian theatre, they have Telegram channels. I've often quoted the very interesting Telegram channel published by Group of Forces North. And of course, it is on Telegram that the blogging community, the various people that write and discuss various aspects of the war are based. They are more comfortable being there than they are on Western platforms, which is, of course, completely unsurprising. So for these people, the closure of Telegram in Russia has come as a shock, and they have been angrily complaining about it. And there's also been complaints from various units within the Russian military, because it turns out that some of them have also been using Telegram as a communications channel, supplementing the more conventional communications channels that the Russian military itself has. I mean, the usual radio and encrypted radio links and all of that. So for these people, it's come as a shock that Telegram has suddenly been switched off across the entire territory of the Russian Federation. And by the way, it's not just Telegram that is affected. The Russians have been taking steps against WhatsApp. And by the way, they've also been taking steps, apparently, against YouTube, which, for the record, I could very easily access when I went to Russia last, in June of last year. I had no trouble accessing YouTube at all, despite various claims, but which I now understand it is extremely difficult to access from within Russia, except through the various workarounds which all of you who follow these programs, sophisticated people as you are, obviously already know about. So, just saying. Now, there is a lot of speculation as to why this has happened, why the Russians have suddenly acted in this way. And I am going to suggest what seems to me to be the obvious reason. The Ukrainians have been using all of these platforms, maybe not so much YT, YouTube, but probably WhatsApp and definitely Telegram to communicate with their agents within Ukraine itself, within Russia itself, rather. And probably they've been doing an awful lot of their coordination and their contacts with the various people they're trying to reach out to in Russia through these platforms. And not only that, but I suspect that some of these entire operations that we have seen, quite plausibly, the Operation Spiderweb attack on the strategic bomber bases, but also possibly the planning and discussion and operations with respect to the attack on Alexeyev and others. I suspect that a lot of that was done using Telegram especially, and perhaps the other social media channels as well. So the Russians acting in this way are basically cutting off the main communications streams. It is going to be much more difficult in future for the various agents that Ukraine has in Russia to communicate with each other or with their controllers in Kiev than it has been up to now. And I am going to suggest that this may also have some part to play in the story of the closure of the Russian, or closure of access to supposedly illegal terminals, Starlink terminals in Russia, about which we have been hearing so much about over the last few weeks. Now, there's been much discussion about this. Much of it has centred on the supposed problems that this might be causing to the Russian military on the front lines. Supposedly, they rely on Starlink. I am absolutely confident that overwhelmingly they don't. Some units, some advanced units might have done so, but I am sure that they were not relying on Starlink altogether. The Russians did use Starlink to conduct drone attacks deep inside Ukraine. Amongst those, however, who probably were using Starlink, including illegal terminals on Russian territory itself, to communicate, I strongly suspect they included Ukrainian agents in Russia itself. And of course, from the American-Ukrainian point of view, I wonder whether the various cells of Russian agents in Ukraine have also been communicating with Moscow via Starlink as well. I mean, it seems obvious to me. Now, again, I'm not going to put together all the moving parts because I don't know all the various parts that are moving. I don't know what instructions have been given. But the most drastic action so far has been taken from in Moscow. Some of it has probably been in preparation for some time. The Russians have been having conflicts with Durov and Telegram going back some years, going back all the way to 2018. But I wonder whether the recent attack on Alexeyev crystallized all of the concerns and led to a decision to take action now. Just saying. And I wonder whether the American disconnection of Starlink might have had some connection to these events as well, in ways which I am not able, obviously, to understand and which I am not going to discuss further. Anyway, I mention all of this because it is all very interesting and it does perhaps also tie together with the rumours about an Oreshnik strike on Kiev. Well, anyway, putting all that aside, the war, of course, itself goes on. We've not had more missile strikes from the Russians, or at least not, no more big missile strikes from the Russians against Ukraine over the last couple of days, or last couple of hours, at least not on the same scale as before. Though, to be clear, the energy crisis in Ukraine remains enormous and continues to deepen and get worse. And there is clearly now a major humanitarian crisis affecting Ukrainian civilians. Just saying. But there continues to be quite a lot of movement now on the front lines. There's been a lot of discussion on the Ukrainian side of the internet about attacks by this counterattack that the Ukrainians are supposed to be carrying out in Zaporozhye. There have been very interesting discussions of this counterattack by Radovka. The fact that Radovka, by the way, is discussing this counterattack, which is taking place both in eastern Zaporozhye and in western Zaporozhye, in other words, both east and west of Orekhov, in both places where the Russians have been advancing significantly over the last few weeks. Anyway, the fact that Radovka is talking about them proves conclusively that some sort of counterattack by the Ukrainians is taking place. But Radovka also says that the counterattacks up to now have been unsuccessful, that the Ukrainians have regained some ground, particularly on the western end of Zaporozhye region, that they have indeed recaptured or reoccupied northern Primorsky, the village on the Dnieper, but that the Ukrainians have proved unable to capture any of the main positions of the Russians in any part of Zaporozhye. Radovka specifically denies Ukrainian claims that the village of Lyubimovka has been recaptured by the Ukrainians. And the Russians have also, up to now, been denying that the village of Ternovata has been recaptured by the Ukrainians. But clearly some kind of a counterattack is taking place. Now, at this point, I'm going to express my own view, which I notice is identical, or essentially identical, to that of Scott of Calibrated. This is that the Ukrainians regularly carry out counterattacks. Many of these so-called counterattacks involve little more than small groups of men, two or three at a time, trying to infiltrate deep behind Russian lines in quieter places, raising a Ukrainian flag, having a photograph made, and then retreating back. Given that the front lines are very permeable, especially Zaporozhye region, where we're talking about open steppe land, it's not at all surprising that this sort of thing happens. I think there was an awful lot of that going on in Kupiansk back in the autumn. The fact that Ukrainians show themselves in some particular place and might wave a flag there doesn't mean that they are in any significant control or that it has any real relevance to the overall battle. But putting all that aside, and quite a lot of that is taking place and has taken place in the past, the overall point made by myself in the past, but perhaps with more expertise behind it by Scott of Calibrated, appears to me to be absolutely correct. The Ukrainians do not have the strength, they do not have the forces anymore to conduct offensives that not only recapture ground and are able to hold it for any length of time. When the Ukrainians conduct counterattacks, these are generally disorganized and quickly improvised. They usually result in very high losses, and the gains that are made are ephemeral because the Ukrainians cannot rehold the territory that they briefly recapture. It's probably also the case, going back to an article that an American military officer, Marinus, wrote back in early 2022, right at the start of the special military operation, that in many of the instances when the Ukrainians claim that they have made advances, what has actually happened is that they have been lured into fire sacks by the Russians themselves, where, of course, they can be hit by shells and drones in and suffer enormous losses, further losses. Regardless, and it has been the consistent pattern over the last 2 years, basically since the fall of Avdiivka in February 2024, whenever the Ukrainians conduct counterattacks, even if they do gain some ground in some places, the Russians fairly quickly take it back. And frankly, in my opinion, more often than not, they have not been driven out of it in the first place. So anyway, I'm not going to discuss the Zaporozhye counterattack further. It does seem to me as if the Ukrainians have not achieved whatever major objectives they set themselves there. I fully expect the Russian offensive towards Orekhov and the city of Zaporozhye to resume some point in the next few weeks. I think this is an area of high priority for the Russians. There's actually been lots of reports that the Russian forces south of Orakhov have now been pushing northward, and that there is actually fighting going on the outskirts of Orakhov, which, by the way, would be consistent with information recently provided by the chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces, who is also the overall commander, General Gerasimov. And anyway, one way or the other, I am absolutely sure that this Ukrainian counteroffensive is going to be like so many other Ukrainian counteroffensives that we have seen up to now, an exercise in futility, an exercise in losing more lives of brave men and more forces, an exercise again in trying to hold undefendable positions, one which will weaken the Ukrainians, both in the area where the counter-offensives are taking place, enabling the Russian advance, future Russian advance, to become faster, and one which is draining supplies, not so much of men, because I don't think actually that the Ukrainians are moving that many men from various parts of the front lines at the moment, but certainly of precious supplies from other parts of the front line where they are sorely needed. And this no doubt explains why we've been seeing a significant acceleration of the Russian advance in the area in the north, in northern Donbass, in Slavyansk, near Slavyansk, why it looks as if resistance around Liman is now disintegrating rapidly, and why the Russians have been able to make further significant advances north of Pokrovsk, with Grishino and other places now coming clearly under their control. Anyway, that's the state of the war. The state of the war continues to be bad, and I remain of the view that the main battle at the moment continues to be Konstantinovka, and my sense is that this is Konstantinovka again, with the desperate attempts of the Ukrainian military to try to hold on to Konstantinovka, that it is also rapidly becoming yet another in the long succession of graveyards of the Ukrainian army. Anyway, that's my general assessment of the situation on the front lines today. Obviously, this is, as I said, provided at some speed. I will no doubt provide more details later, but that's all that I'm going to say at the moment. In the meantime, we have other pieces moving across the board, and it's becoming increasingly complicated because we have all of these various crises taking place around the world, in Ukraine, in Iran, in Cuba, except that it's difficult increasingly to avoid the sense that these are all manifestations of one single big great crisis. Now, the epicentre at the moment is probably Munich, where the leaders of what used to be called the Collective West were supposed to be gathering. Now, interestingly, Donald Trump, has not gone, nor has the Vice President, J.D. Vance. Instead, the person who has represented the United States at this meeting, which has always been the main big gathering of the military, security, political leadership of the collective West. If Davos brings together all the important people in the European Union. Munich brings together all the important people in the sister organisation, connected to the sister organisation, which is NATO. Of course, most of these people are the same people. Just saying, it's a single community, but they have two different organisations. So, of course, they have to have two different conferences. Anyway, they're all there, except, as I said, that the Americans are there on a much smaller scale than they have been in some other years. And they're represented there by Marco Rubio. Now, interestingly enough, Rubio has gone to Munich, but he skipped the meeting, the part of the meeting in Munich, which was connected concerning the conflict in Ukraine. The major single conflict taking place in Europe at the moment, and the conflict which, until a year and a half ago, was far and away the biggest topic being discussed at the Munich Security Conference, going all the way back to the start of the conflict in February 2022. So this is the part of the meeting that used to be the core part of the meeting at the Munich Security Conference, and Rubio doesn't go. He says that there is a scheduling error, that there are scheduling issues, which is a frankly polite way of saying that Rubio has more important things to talk about at the moment than the conflict in Ukraine itself. Now, what I'm hearing, what I read, by the way, yesterday in the Financial Times, is that the Europeans were stunned, that they didn't like this at all. The Financial Times said that a European official said that he found this incredible. I think that probably the language used was much stronger. It was also conceded that without the Americans present, this entire meeting to discuss Ukraine had lost all significance. That there was really very little to discuss, because without the Americans, the main actor in the drama was not there. Hamlet was not there in the play about the prince. So anyway, that was one thing that Rubio did. Then he gave a speech, and it was a typical speech of Rubio's, extremely cleverly written, saying many of the right things, or giving the impression of doing so. But actually, if you drill down and read it very carefully, it's probably not the kind of speech that the Europeans themselves would have been happy with, because he says that, yes, the United States is still part of NATO. It still takes NATO very seriously. It still takes the Allies very seriously. But when you read it carefully, it makes it completely clear that this is no longer, even by appearance, a partnership. Rather, it is a relationship of master and servants, that the United States is the master and the Europeans are there to do whatever it is that Washington wants. Well, you could argue that it has always been so, and I would not disagree. But the Europeans are still very unaccustomed to being treated openly in such a way, and frankly, they don't like it. What the Europeans are, however, doing is something else. All sorts of European leaders have been turning up. Merz is there, Macron is there, Starmer is there. Starmer, of course, has his own problems in London, but nonetheless, he comes to Munich and he speaks at Munich. And the thing that unites all of these people is that, of course, they're talking about the conflict, about war. And they're talking about the need for Europe to rearm and to rely on the Americans less, and for Europe to prepare for war, because war with Russia is coming. on the one hand, and you saw an extreme example of this in the NATO, in the case of the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte. Mark Rutte derides, ridicules the Russian army. He says it is advancing at the rate of a snail. He says that the Russians are achieving nothing in the war. At the same time, he talks about this enormous threat from Russia, as all of the other European leaders also do. By the way, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in his various comments over the course of the last week, has himself drawn attention to this bizarre dissonance that the Europeans make Russia fearsome and mighty when they want to, and incompetent and weak when they want to, and they switch from one narrative to the other whenever it suits them. Anyway, the major theme of this conference from the European side, it's clear, is preparation for war. Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, who, as I said, is, in my opinion, I have no doubt about it, hold under the waterline, whose premiership is not so much on life support. I think it's already dead to all intents and purposes. But, you know, it exists in a kind of zombie state. Anyway, he comes along to Munich. And, of course, he is also talking about war. He says that we should vote for the Labour Party in elections in Britain, because we can't trust the rivals to the Labour Party, the Greens and Reform, because unlike the Labour Party, they're soft and they might not protect us properly from the Russians. I mean, he is now actually saying that. And as far as I can tell, this is now going to be the big pitch of the Labour Party to the British voters over the next few months and, for all I know, years. So it's now going to be focused on war, on the threat from Russia, on the bear on the prowl. We're going to have all of these stories, and the cascade of commentary and discussion about this is going to become incredible in Britain, and not just in Britain, of course, but across Europe. And Starmer also says that in order to safeguard British interests and British security, he's going to order the British fleet, a carrier force, and one of Britain's aircraft carriers and its accompanying escorts to patrol the Arctic against the Russian Navy. This is a Navy whose carriers can barely leave port, apparently, because they're in a state of chronic disrepair and lack aircraft. They have to borrow them from the Americans, and he's going to send them into the Arctic to confront the Russians. I don't know what the Russians make of all of this, but anyway, that's the story. But of course, he's not the only one who is talking in this extraordinary way. They are all talking now, all of them, about Russia, about war, about the prospect of war. They're also saying that we need to support Ukraine, because even as the Russian army is incompetent and corrupt and slow and advances at the pace of a snail, if Ukraine falls, supposedly, we are going to have this enormous, mighty Russian army on our eastern borders. And again, obviously, that must mean that the threat from Russia is there and that they're going to embark on the great war of conquest across Europe. Why the Russians would want to conquer Europe, why they would want to take over Europe, is left always unexplained. What the Russian purpose in such a war is, as I said, no one can ever truly say. But again, the drumbeat is there. You can see this in speech after speech. And the drumbeat also involves demands that defence spending must be increased, that in the middle of a budgetary crisis and a financial crisis and an economic crisis and deindustrialization in Germany, nonetheless, what we must do is that we must increase defence spending to meet this enormous threat from the Russians. There's an article, I believe it is in Politico, which says that the great problem the European leaders have is that even as they talk in this way about the threat from Russia and talk about the need to increase defence spending, they run up against the obstacle that their people, the people of Europe, are completely unenthusiastic to the point almost of being opposed to this whole exercise. So when people are asked in the abstract, do you agree to increase defence spending? The answer tends to be yes. But when it is suggested that taxes be raised or debt be taken on or social spending be cut or health spending or education spending be cut, or pensions be cut to finance this defence spending, the answer is a categorical and resounding no. And recruitment into the European militaries remains a severe problem. Germany was supposed to deploy, I believe it was a brigade, to Lithuania to protect Lithuania from the Russian army, except, of course, it turns out that the German army couldn't find recruits to make up the numbers for this brigade. I believe only a fraction of the number needed to man this brigade have come forward. And of course, this doesn't even address the industrial questions which people like myself, Brian Beletic and others have brought up so many times. I spoke recently about how Germany and France were unable to agree about the joint fighter project that they have been talking about since 2015, and it looks as if that has collapsed. And of course, that's only just one example of amongst many others. It was the NATO Secretary General himself, Mark Rutte, who recently said that any idea of Europe replacing the United States was sheer fantasy, that Europe would need to spend at least 10% of its GDP on defence for years to come to be able to match the kind of military resources that the United States has positioned in Europe if these were taken away. And as Mark Rutte knows perfectly well, that simply isn't going to happen. We've also had a whole series of exercises, apparently. These are paper exercises, perhaps war games would be a more accurate way of describing them. One apparently pitted a Ukrainian drone unit against two NATO brigades or battalions. And apparently within about an hour of the start of this exercise, the two NATO, war game, these battalions were decimated. And there's been lots of stories and reports and rumours about another war game. Again, these are paper war games. No actual soldiers or material have moved. But it was about a war game involving a Russian attack on the Sulwaki Gap, the gap between Kaliningrad and Belarus, the gap that is made up apparently of Lithuanian territory. And it basically said that the Russians would have little problem breaking through, and all it would require is a force of about 15,000 Russian troops, and there was scarcely any possible way that NATO could counter it. Some of this may be exaggerated and overstated in order to drum up more defence spending, And I don't myself think that we are in the situation where these sort of crises are likely to flare up immediately. But anyway, one can see that the situation is becoming critical and very difficult for Western militaries, European militaries, and there is no realistic way that this situation can be remedied anytime soon. Now, I actually read about the British Army, which, since I live in Britain and I hold British citizenship, and since I consider myself as much British as I consider myself Greek, it's a country that I know very well and care about. Anyway, I recently read that the British military, the whole British army of 75,000 men, is now outnumbered in Russia by the number of Russian drone operators operating within the Russian military. Russia has more drone operators than Britain has soldiers. Now, that perhaps illustrates the colossal imbalance that is now appearing. And the extraordinary thing about all of this rhetoric about war that we're hearing all the time is that the Americans clearly do not want to be in a war with Russia. Rubio skipping meetings to discuss Ukraine, the Americans sending pushing the Ukrainians towards negotiations and telling them, you've got to negotiate with the Russians. Whatever it actually means, it strongly suggests that the Americans at the moment do not want to take on the Russians in a head-to-head conflict. In fact, I'm sure they don't. In spite of all of that, in spite of the fantasy of the Europeans being able to take on the Russians, and the complete lack of need to do so, because as I said, the Russians have no logical reason to want to occupy the whole of Europe. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense for them to want to do it. This rhetoric about war, about conflict with Russia, continues unabated and is now reaching fever pitch. If in February 2022, at the Munich Security Conference that took place just before the start of the special military operation, there was a sense of excitement and delirium about the conflict, the coming conflict with Russia, and about the enormous sanctions that would be imposed on Russia, which would break Russia and cause Putin's fall and open the way, presumably, for Western investment into a fragmented and defeated Russia. This time, it is all talk about war against the Russian threat, despite the fact that everybody knows that this is a threat that neither exists, nor one which Europe could counter if it did exist, which thankfully it doesn't. Now, to get a sense of the unreality, I was reading again in the British newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, which is, it must be said, one of the most surreal of newspapers, an article by a man called Matthew Lynn, who I have actually a significant respect for. He's a very clever man, and he writes about economics often in an interesting way, though one which I don't always agree with. But anyway, Matthew Lynn was talking about the energy situation in Britain. He said that British businesses pay four times more for their electricity than the United States does, and twice more than France does. And he blamed the whole thing on the British government's push towards renewables. Well, I'm not saying that renewables have no part in this story, but you go through it, you read the whole article, and you won't find there any mention of Nord Stream 1, Nord Stream 2, explosions, natural gas, sanctions on Russia. any of those things, it's as if this reality again of Britain and of the European Union making their energy situation what it is today, as if that didn't really exist. You don't want to talk about it. You want to talk about the threat from the East, but you don't want to talk about the steps that you have yourself taken that makes that potential threat, if it existed, much more real, much more dangerous than it would otherwise be. I am utterly baffled by this. But anyway, there it is. Now, I said that all of these various crises are coming together. There is increasing amount of information about Chinese and Russian assistance to Iran. And there has been an essential article on Sonar 21 by Larry Johnson that discusses this. For example, he mentioned something which I myself missed. It was so poorly reported that I was not aware of the fact that in January, the Russians, the Chinese and the Iranians actually came to a public trilateral agreement which appears to have security components that they came to get together with each other. There is actually some kind of mutual treaty between these three powers. Now, the text of this treaty has not been made public. We had last year the partnership agreement between Russia and Iran, and the year before we had a partnership agreement between Iran and China. But all these two agreements have now been solidified by a trilateral agreement that brings together all three. And again, Larry Johnson provides a lot of the information. Again, much of this is based on rumour and speculation, but much of the information about the assistance that both the Russians and the Chinese are providing to Iran at the present time. And much of it appears to involve radar systems, intelligence systems. Larry Johnson says that the Chinese have been supplying advanced surface-to-air missiles to Iran, China's equivalent of the S-300 system. Now, I find it very difficult to believe that the Iranians have trained to the level of having proficiency in this system. Though, of course, it may be that the military relationship between Iran and China is much older than I know. And it could be that the Iranians have been training on this system for some time. But again, if it has indeed been deployed to Iran, and if the Chinese are providing missiles to Iran, then, logically, that must mean that there are Chinese technicians in Iran working on establishing the system. So all of this is going on. The Chinese are playing their part. The Russians definitely are playing their part. And it looks as if there are economic agreements as well. I still ask myself the question, if all of these agreements are already there and are already in place, why did the Iranian authorities not turn to the Russians and much more to the Chinese for help with the economic crisis that struck Iran in late December with the collapse of the rial, which led to the protests in January, which have been the pretext, if you like, for the current crisis. Now, as to those protests and that financial crisis, we've now had a truly extraordinary succession of admissions from the United States. So a couple of days ago, the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, openly bragged that it was the United States that caused the collapse of the real, that it was the Americans who created a dollar shortage in Iran, which led to the imminent collapse of one of the Iranian banks, which in turn forced the Iranian central bank to print rials to bail out that bank, which caused the surge in inflation and the decline, the collapse of the real. So Scott Bessent has told us that this is something that the Americans did and which they themselves planned. Now, we've had an article by the Wall Street Journal which straightforwardly admits that it was the United States that smuggled the Starlink terminals into Iran, which were used by the various agitators and people to coordinate the protests inside Iran. So we have had a succession of admissions that the Americans caused the economic crisis, which led to the protests, and that the Americans played a central role in generating and organizing the protests through the smuggling into Iran of the Starlink terminals. And yesterday, we had a further admission from no less a person than the President of the United States himself, saying that yes, absolutely, regime change in Iran is the optimal option. Who can dispute any longer that this is what this whole thing is all about? The economic crisis, the protests, the objective being regime change. The Americans are openly telling us all about this. And the Americans, of course, are still saying that they want to talk to Iran and to see whether a deal can be done. Marco Rubio said in Munich that Trump would be perfectly happy to meet Ayatollah Khamenei himself to see if he can agree a deal. Very, very unwise, by the way, for Khamenei to agree to meet Trump at a time like this. Just saying. But anyway, but we see from information that's been openly talked about now in the United States, what has brought us exactly to this point of crisis. And of course, we now have the next meeting in Geneva of the Trilateral Working Party, the Americans, the Russians and the Ukrainians. Medinsky will now be heading the Russian delegation, as I set out, as I discussed in my program yesterday. It turns out that Witkoff and Kushner are also going to be there again. Meanwhile, Trump tells Zelensky, hurry up, please, do the deal with the Russians. The Russians are ready to do a deal. Everybody's waiting on you. All you need to do is to give up Donbass. Zelensky, of course, is not going to agree to that. He's make more comments, basically making it clear that he has no intention of doing what the Americans want. And of course, as he always does, he will be at the Munich Security Conference, and we're likely to get another speech from him demanding more from the Europeans, still more, which the Europeans are going to give him. Well, all of that is going on. Larry Johnson has also pointed out that even as the Russians are preparing to rush oil to Cuba, the Chinese are also providing economic help to Cuba. They're sending supplies of rice to Cuba. This can be done by air, by the way. There's been large numbers of Russian air flights to Cuba, which people are wondering what they're bringing. I wonder whether what they are bringing our supplies of Chinese rice. Putin and Xi discussed the situation in Cuba over the course of their virtual meeting a few days ago. And it seemed to me that the Chinese and the Russians were coordinating positions. And this is clearly part of what the two sides agree. And it turns out that the Chinese are also trying to send, again, it's easy to do by air. Maybe that's also other parts of the cargo in these Aleutian planes. Anyway, it looks as if the Chinese are also sending the solar panels and all of these things to provide electric power to Cuba in this moment of crisis. Anyway, all of that is being rushed to Cuba at the moment. And of course, the oil supplies, the Russians say, are coming. It looks as if, just as the Chinese and the Russians are working together to rescue Iran, or at least to help Iran in this moment of crisis, that they're trying to do the same with Cuba as well. And we are now getting more reports that the BRICS states, which means ultimately China and Russia, are working together with their various, or moving forward with their various steps to complete the architecture of their financial systems. So there's reports that BRICS Pay has now started to operate in Russia. I saw a report to this effect. I'm not sure this is true, by the way. I also saw another report, which again, I'm not sure whether this is true, and don't take this as read, but that China has told India that henceforth, China is prepared to support India's application for a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. That would make the Western powers the only remaining objectors, if it is true. I am not sure it is true. But there doesn't seem to be any doubt that the Chinese government itself has now given instructions to Chinese banks and financial institutions to sell treasury bonds and to cease buying treasury bonds, and that the Chinese are once again heavily involved in building up their reserves and buying gold. Well, you can put all of these various pieces together. But as I said, it does seem to me that we are indeed now looking at a crisis, a conflict between a superpower, the United States, indisputably a superpower, trying to maintain its positions around the world, trying to secure its heartland, its hinterland, the Western Hemisphere, and taking more aggressive steps against its adversaries, China and Russia, and of China and Russia, pushed by the actions of the superpower, starting to make their own take their own retaliatory steps, starting to push backwards in whatever way they can. And those ways, I'm going to suggest, are likely to turn out to be increasingly effective. So it is, we are definitely in interesting times. Meanwhile, to repeat again, the main conflict at the moment remains Ukraine. There are reports that the United States is now planning a campaign against Iran that is supposed to last several weeks. The idea is to attack nuclear facilities, but also to attack command centers, nodes of control across Iran, to conduct that kind of sustained aerial campaign against Iran. I wonder how long this can be sustained when the United States and its allies began operations against Iran in 1991, on the eve of the first US-Iraq war. I remember that it took months for the United States to pre-position supplies. Something like 1 million armed men, both ground forces and aircraft and ships, were deployed. And the aerial campaign was enormous. But even then, I understand that beyond a certain point, it became difficult to sustain. There is nothing like that concentration of troops against Iran at the moment. We have one carrier group. Another carrier with its group, the Gerald Ford, is definitely being redeployed to the Arabian Sea. There are rumours, as I discussed in my programme yesterday, about a third carrier. If only two carriers are deployed, then we are looking at a force of roughly the same size as the force that the United States deployed against Iran during the 12-day war in June last year, and which the United States deployed against the Houthis in March last year. In neither case was the force enough. And, well, we've heard stories about empty missile cupboard in terms of air defence missiles. The United States does have thousands of Tomahawk missiles, but the production lines are said to be basically closed or running very slow, given that the United States has a potential conflict in East Asia. Can it really afford to expend hundreds of Tomahawk missiles attacking targets across Iran? And, well, what happens if over the course of that war, that conflict, the Iranians begin to strike back? If they strike back at American bases and at bases in Israel and in other places, is this really sustainable? What if the Iranians also close the Straits of Hormuz? And I'm not even now looking at some of the more dramatic scenarios that some people have outlined. Attacks on the carriers themselves, for example. I think that, yes, the United States can sustain a war against Iran for a couple of weeks. But the Iranians may be thinking of a conflict that is not weeks in duration, but months in duration. And there, I think, there are going to be significant problems on the American side. Now, of course, any conflict between the United States and Iran that draws down American arsenals is going to have a catastrophic effect on the conflict in Ukraine. The Ukrainians, for all the claims about European weapons being sent to Ukraine, still depend heavily on European American supplies. In terms of air defense missiles, it looks as if Patriot missiles are basically the only game in town. There's been a recent report, I haven't read it, which suggests that the German Leopard tanks have been completely unsuccessful in Ukraine. And they are in short supply too. If Iran becomes drawn in, if the United States becomes drawn in to a long conflict against Iran, this will have enormous economic consequences, especially if the Iranians close the Straits of Hormuz, but it's going to have immediate catastrophic consequences for Ukraine itself. Now, the Russians see this, they watch everything, they are obviously preparing for all of this. Everybody now, I think, acknowledges that a major Russian offensive in Ukraine is on its way. Probably it will start in April. That's the date that seems most logical after the spring thaw. By that step, it's difficult to imagine that Ukraine will be in any position to resist it. And for the moment, to repeat again, the diplomacy is stuck and is leading nowhere. All this talk in Europe of war with Russia becomes easy to understand in this atmosphere of crisis. But the Europeans are in no condition to wage such a war. They should put aside their ideas of war and they should work instead to achieve peace. Macron occasionally talks about the need for dialogue with the Russians. He's done nothing up to now to put it into effect, and his rhetoric remains disastrous. One should be grateful for the fact, I suppose, that he is talking about it at all, but others need to think about this too. Merz, however, gives every impression of still being opposed. And of course, the Baltic states, the European Commission leadership, the NATO leadership, they all give the impression of being opposed also. These people need to wake up from their daydreams and look at the reality around them, though one wonders whether they ever will. Anyway, this is where I finish my program today. Let me remind you that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. Please remember to support us via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, as I said before, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel.